It's one small step for man.
There is no planet B.
I stand here today humbled.
You turn if you want to.
I will not be lectured about sexism.
The winner is Cindy.
This week in history.
3 years ago, when Queen Elizabeth II died, there was no question about who would become the next British and therefore Australian head of state, because King Charles had been prime for the job since the day he was born. And after the brief period in the 1650s, when the British monarchy was dissolved and Oliver Cromwell was running the show, well, when the crown was restored, it went to somebody who was the son of the previous king. But what happens when you start a monarchy from scratch and you've got no royal family to choose your king or queen from? Well, in the case of Greece, after the country kicked out the Ottomans in the 1820s, all sorts of measures were tried, including asking, well, any old royal from Europe if they'd be up for the job, and even holding plebiscites to vote for who Greece's next top king would be. And it was back in November 1862, Greeks were busy at the ballot box voting for who they thought should be their next king then. Rather than picking one of their own, they went for one of Queen Victoria's sons, the number two son, Prince Alfred. In fact, between 1830 and 1875, the Greek monarchy had quite the ride. It was abolished, restored, abolished again. So it's quite an interesting period in history. Now, to explore it, I've got my favourite Greek historian, Rhasidas Karel, is back with us, who is the Sir Nicholas Laurentis Professor of Modern Greek at the University of Sydney. Hey, Ras, welcome back.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's such a complex issue.
Right? Yes. And you've talked to us before about the Greek Revolution, which was taking part in the 1820s and sort of ends with the Greeks becoming independent. And so when they became independent, they hadn't really had a monarchy at all, had they?
No, they were for 400 years under the Ottoman Sultan, so they didn't, there was no monarchy. And as you remember from history, the Ottomans always wanted to persecute and prosecute and in reality exterminate all aristocratic families of Byzantium, just in case that will some of them survive and claim the throne at Constantinople. So most aristocratic families of Byzantium had disappeared by then, so there was a problem there.
Yeah, that's still going back away, isn't it?
What are we going to do? Who is going to govern this country? Meanwhile, there was a political problem also. Mm. What was the political problem? That during the revolution, we had three very progressive and extremely, if I may use the term, revolutionary constitutions. Mm. The constitutions actually prescribed the formation of a republic after the establishment of the Greek state. And if you remember that period, they were talking about the tyranny, about the tyrants. When they talk about the tyrants, they talk about the monarchs of Europe, monarchy as a system. So they wanted, following the French, the American and the French revolutions, they wanted to establish a new republic without titles of aristocracy or social class distinctions and these kind of things. So they wanted to establish a republic on the basis of equality.
So why didn't that happen?
Because they invited in the beginning the famous John Kapodistrias, the first governor of Greece. He was not a prime minister, he was the first governor of Greece, mm-hmm. as a transitional figure to create, and establish and consolidate the political system. But the Greeks, as you understand, then after so many years, so many centuries and years of revolution, didn't understand what law-abiding citizens were about. Kapodistrias came from Russia. He said that you all go obey this legal system that I'm imposing, that introducing now to the country. So what did they do? They killed him. The first the political assassination. The Greek state begins with a political assassination.
Right, so that didn't go well then.
No,
didn't
not
start
at all.
Well.
And so there was for 2 years we had a anarchy.
Yeah.
The Greeks fighting with each other.
Oh, so here we are. We've got our independence. We'll kill the guy who's going to sort of help us through this. Then we're going to fight amongst ourselves.
Okay, so they destroyed even their own, one of the most famous leaders of the revolution destroyed the navy, the whole navy of Greece, and the fleet, the fighting fleet. So Greece for 3 years was completely defenseless.
Wow.
So then they decided to, the great powers, they called that guaranteed the independence of Greece, decided to intervene and impose a system of monarchy because, as I said, the Greeks proved themselves unable to govern themselves.
Right. So this is what Russia, Britain and France,
And France.
Yeah. And so they have this big conference in London, didn't they? And what happened there?
Well, they decided, they put forward three or four names. One was, you know, from England. The other one was Leopold, who went to Mexico and he was killed later on. First was Leopold, then from England. But then England withdrew. They said, we're not going to impose any member of the royal family from these three powers that guaranteed the independence of Greece for obvious reasons of political influence. And so,
so the Russians don't want a Brit on the Greek throne.
They were the Greek.
You know, and the Brits don't want the Russians.
The Russians didn't want the English didn't want a Russian there.
Right.
And the French didn't want either of them.
Right. So then they're kind of looking around going, who are we going to get to be the king?
Who are we going to get here? You know, just in, and they found, of course, King Otto, you know, from Bavaria, the son of the King Ludwig of Bavaria, the famous King Ludwig of Bavaria, who the famous, for those of you who like the scandals of history, later on fell in love with Lola Montez.
If you remember
the famous dancer Lola Montez and abandoned his throne for that woman.
Okay, and she did tours of Ballarat, so there's an Australian connection there for sure.
She was, and he came here as well, the father of Otto. But Otto, he was only 16, 17 years old. He went to Greece in 1833. The first thing he did, of course, was to transfer the capital city from Nafplion to Athens.
It wasn't in Athens at that point.
No, no. Athens was, if I may use the term, a small village inhabited by Albanians mostly in that period. Plus, the Acropolis of Athens still was occupied by the Turks, a Turkish, you know, army.
You hadn't got rid of them yet?
No.
They were, goodness me.
You know, okay. Because of the way that the Acropolis is, you can't get rid unless you have heavy artillery or heavy aircraft to bombard the place.
As the Venetians did. How long did they remain there?
At the end of 1833, when they were actually bought. They were given money to get out of there, you know, so the Acropolis was given back to Greece then. And then Otto decided that Nafplion, as you understand, was the medieval capital of Greece. It was the Peloponnese, the first place that became free and independent. To this day, if I may say, to speak to the touristy, you know, tendency amongst trends amongst our listeners, if you want to see the most beautiful Greek city, you have to go to Nafplion. Athens is the most touristy, but Nafplion is the most beautiful city in Greece.
Rasidas Karolis is here. He's the Sir Nicholas Laurentis Professor of Modern Greek at the University of Sydney. And we're kind of piecing together the way that, the Greeks, I don't know if embraced is the right word, but played with monarchy in the years after the Greek Revolution.
If I may say, it was imposed upon them. Yeah. As a first thing, you know, that from now on, there will be no independent foreign policy for the state, that state, which had to follow mostly, say, the geopolitics of the day. Mm-hmm. One side was Russia, because of the Orthodox Church and the Orthodox tradition, wanted to have an influence on the new kingdom. And on the other hand, the political elite of the country, led by Alexandros Mavrokordatos, one of the most important politicians of that period, who was a very close friend of the Greek Romantics, especially of the English Romantics, especially Byron, Shelley, and Keats. He had an affair with Mary Shelley, you know, to give another scandal here. And he was very pro-British, and he believed that Greece had to introduce the system of policies and politics that we had in England in that period.
Mm. So did Otto, when he took the job, I mean, was he kind of pro-Greece, or is he really about keeping everyone else happy?
Well, Greece, as you know, is always under the cloud of ancient Greece.
Mm.
His father, Ludwig, before getting enamored with Lola Montez, wanted to make Munich the Athens of the North. If you go to Munich today, you will see even a replica of the Parthenon there, looming large over the city. So you had this incredible love for ancient Greece, classicism, the attempt to reinvent the classical glory and grandeur that he thought that the Greeks had in antiquity in Athens. So he went to Athens. He went to Greece believing that he was going to find the descendants, direct descendants of Homer, Plato, Socrates, and Pericles.
Mm-hmm.
But in reality, he found a completely orientalized society. There were camels in the center of Athens in that period. There was very heavily oriental, even Abyssinian, Ethiopian mm-hmm. colony in the middle of in the center of Athens. To this day, it's called, if you go to an area called Monastiraki, it's called the Square, Abyssinia Square, because of the Ethiopians living there. And he was a bit shocked. So he tried to essentially discover Greece.
Mm.
But he discovered Greece through the prism of ancient Greek classicism, that sense of, you know, going back to the roots of Greece. So he didn't know what to do with the Orthodox Church because he was Catholic, but not Orthodox. He got married with Amalia, who was also a Catholic and not Orthodox, with the promise that their offsprings will become Orthodox. He didn't speak Greek. So we had all these problems, as you understand, which led to 1843, to the famous constitutional revolution that we had in Greece. If you go to the center of Athens, you'll see it's called Constitution Square in front of the parliament, because the army and the people actually rebelled against him, and they forced him to abandon absolute monarchy and create constitutional monarchy.
Uh-huh. And he ended up being deposed in 1862, so it didn't end well for him.
No, because once an absolute monarch, always an absolute monarch. You can't share your power with the plebs, as you understand, who are elected between essentially the landlords and this sort of a kind of very uncouth citizens of the country. We must not forget that the citizens back then were only the people who could vote, that is to say, who had properties rights.
I was wondering. Now, let's talk about the vote, because Otto gets deposed, and then there was a decision made, and this is 1862, so sort of 30 years later. A decision gets made to have a vote on who are we going to have for the next king? So was it a short list, or did those who could vote just vote for whoever they thought would be a good king?
As you know from history, it was a very strange referendum, plebiscite. It lasted for almost 15 to 20 days. So everybody voted whenever they wanted. Mm. There was no way that you count who voted whom and won. But at the end, we had, it started the end of November and ended sometime in the middle of December. So we had 250,000 votes in that period, which was not very much, as you understand, because there were more people living, almost 600,000 people in Greece, in the state of Greece in that period.
Mm.
And most of them were people who lived in the cities, Athens, Nafplion, Patras, and this kind of thing, and only had the property under their name. They were legal owners of property. So poor people, peasants and farmers, didn't have the right to vote. So we're talking about mostly merchants, people who were exposed to the West through trade and this kind of thing. So they voted for, of course, the son of Queen Victoria, who was, you know, the ruling and the reigning emperor, empress, and the empire of the period.
So this is Prince Alfred, the second son. He's not the one who's meant to take the throne because he's the second son. Why didn't everyone vote for him? Why was he so popular?
He was very popular in that period, if I remember well, because of his lifestyle. He was traveling. He was, you know, the newspaper. We must not forget that there's a period that the Fifth Estate, the press, that's become very, very popular in Greece in that period. And most of them believed that if they had an English monarch, England will give them back the seven islands, Corfu, Cephalonia, and Zakynthos, which were a British colony since 1815. And there was a movement of liberation against from them for almost 20 years, which ended up in two very disastrous rebellions, especially in the island of Cephalonia. That's why, you know, there were no British tourists going to Cephalonia until the 1980s.
Wow. Really? Okay, I didn't know that. So he got, as I say, this enormous amount of the vote, something like 95%. But didn't the Greeks already know that there was no way that Prince Alfred was going to be allowed to become the king?
No, they didn't.
Right.
And I think most of the people who voted, they also, as you understand, as happens with the Greeks always, it's a protest vote. They know that their vote does not really matter. And they knew that it didn't really matter.
Right.
So who was appointed as the, who was essentially imposed again upon the Greeks? you know, the Crown Prince of Denmark. Do you remember who came to Greece under the name George the First?
Okay, and how many votes had
six.
He got six votes.
And so
Alfred couldn't do it basically because there was still this rule saying yes the Brits and the French and the Russians.
I don't think that he wanted it particularly because he knew what was happening down there. The Greeks, you know, just. As we mentioned before, after 400 years of occupation, didn't know what it means, of foreign rule, didn't know what it means to live in a law-abiding society. In England, the monarchy and the legal system developed organically within the society. In Greece, they had to be imposed from above. So you, and first of all, you have to take these clefts and the irregulars, that is to say, from the mountains and make them into proper soldiers and then into proper citizens, which was...
Still, wouldn't it be nice for the ego, wouldn't it, to be being voted the next king of Greece, even if you weren't going to be it?
Yeah. Well, but it was difficult, as you understand, in that period, to find someone who would be suitable for Greece. Yeah. And Greece is the only country of the Balkans that imported its monarch. Serbia had a local Serbian monarch. Romania had a Romanian monarch. Bulgaria had a... Greece had to import it.
So even though by the 1860s, wasn't there someone who'd emerged in Greece that could have done the job?
No. Unfortunately, no, it seems, because most of the, you know, just that meant that the political system was not well consolidated in that period. And the first thing I think what he, I mean, George, as a new monarch, the Glücksberg monarchy did in Greece, dynasty did in Greece, was to consolidate the social sphere in the country. And it was, we had relatively 40 years of, you know, stability in the country, despite the geopolitical sort of problems, the constant problems with the Ottoman Empire and the internal transformation of an agricultural society into an industrial society, of a rural society into an urban society. So the whole thing was... relatively stable. We didn't have a big revolution. We didn't have a social unrest. That will happen in the beginning of the 20th century with some socialist movements and this kind of things in the country itself.
And now, Rasidas Karolis is here, Sir Nicholas Laurentis, Professor of Modern Greek at the University of Sydney. And we're just talking about, well, the way that Greece has been governed effectively since the Greek Revolution in the 1820s. And I'm particularly interested in just exploring the role that, monarchy played. Now, the Greeks had hope, and if they voted for Prince Alfred, they might get the Ionian Islands back. They did get them back, though, didn't they?
They did, but it was impossible to keep them anymore because their strategic importance was gone because England, at that period, was negotiating with the Ottoman Empire to purchase Cyprus, which happened in 5 years after later on. You know, just, I mean, a few years later, not 5 years, but it was, they were negotiating because Cyprus became much more important strategically from the Seven Islands because it was just opposite the Suez Canal, which had opened in 1870, 1871. And then it was the essentially, if I may call it, a huge base for the campaigns of the British in the Middle East, whereas the Seven Islands were essentially in the Balkans. The Balkans by then have lost their strategic importance.
And so did Britain just go, oh, you can have them? Have them back?
Or? Yeah, take them back, you know, whatever, you know, which was really a huge, if I may say, loss for the Ionian Islands and the islanders themselves because, as against Greece, they were much more developed. They had
were they? Right.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you go to Corfu today, you'll feel they even play cricket, you know, which means that they were heavily westernized. They were never under the Ottoman rule because they were under the Venetians for 600 to 700 years. So they had a very strong social structure and aristocracy, people, you know, sort of the protocols of behavior. They had really... and a university, they had an educational system that was functioning. All of these were destroyed when they joined Greece, of course, you know, just because Greeks Greece as a country could not maintain this sophisticated system of governance that we had in the Seven Islands themselves.
So King George rules for 50 years. He got assassinated in 1913. What happened to the monarchy after that?
Well, we had the monarchy after that. You know, his death was very suspicious to this day. Who killed him in Thessalonica just a few months after its liberation from the Ottomans, of the Ottoman Empire, and very many things, political games we had in that period. Some people say were the Germans involved, others say were the English, the British, and this kind of thing. So it was a period of if you remember, of Matahari and the spies of the period, because the monarchy in Greece was pro-German, because the King Constantine was married to the Kaiser's sister.
Ah.
But the people of Greece were pro-British.
Mm-hmm.
So what is happening when the First World War broke out? The Greeks want to participate with Britain under the leadership of the most important Greek prime minister, Eleftherios Venizelos. But the monarch, Constantine, wanted to ally himself to Germany. Since he couldn't do it, he declared neutrality.
Uh-huh.
So that created this incredible national division in 1915.
Mm.
Venizelos, after being elected in 1913, he divided the country into two parts, into two states, the state of Athens and the state of Thessalonica.
Mm-hmm.
He went to Thessalonica and declared war against Germany and the powers that, the central powers, as I called them back then. State of Athens remained neutral, if it could stay neutral as well. But anyway, many things happened. Then he was evicted, Constantine.
Constantine, who was George's son.
George's son. And the husband to the sister of Kaiser.
Right. So
the German Kaiser, I mean. You know,
so Constantine has a shot, then he's gone. then he came back for a while.
Yeah. Because Venizelos thought, and this, you know, that the British, who gave the mandate to the Greeks to go to Asia Minor, could not stand a monarch who had sided with the Germans, would never have accepted him. But Venizelos made a serious error of judgment in September 1920. He called for elections, and he lost the elections because the Greeks, after 10 years of war, said, basta.
Mm.
We want to go home now.
And so they say they're going to get rid of the monarchy.
Yeah.
But then they had a referendum in 1924, right?
That referendum happened after the Asia Minor catastrophe.
Right.
When the king suddenly, where he went as a liberator of the Greeks of Asia Minor, when he lost the war, he disappeared. He went to Palermo with his girlfriend, Constantine, where he spent the last days of his life.
Whole thing.
So that was another, you know, as you understand, a sort of a kind of a disastrous sort of a contribution of the monarchy to the political governance of Greece. So in 1924, we have the first Greek Republic declared, which lasted only, unfortunately, for 10 years, because in 1935-36, we had the dictatorship of Metaxas, who called for the king to come back. He had a referendum for restoration of monarchy, and the monarchy received 75% to be restored and 30% against, which is 105%. It was so rigged.
So I was going to ask why the Greeks wanted the monarchy back, but you don't think they did?
No, they didn't. It was Metaxas, the dictator, thought that the British will stand by him and by Greece in the case of the Second World War, that he saw it coming. They brought the king back, who stayed until 1948 with the Greek government in exile. He went to England, then South Africa, and then back to England. And then the last king of Greece, King Paul, was with his wife, Queen Frederica from Germany, who stayed the king in Greece until 1965. And then the last, very last king, the child, King Constantine, who died a few years ago. But he was evicted, first of all, in 1973 by the dictatorship. And then 1975, with the referendum that essentially put an end to this, if I may call it, political irregularity in the political system of Greece. It was a huge irregularity, because suddenly you have essentially a duality of powers. Who was governing the country? The monarch or the parliament?
So in 75, that referendum, was that a legitimate election, do you think?
Well, many people say that it was illegitimate because they didn't allow the king to go back to Greece and campaign on his own behalf, because he was in exile in London. I think it was I was there.
Oh, okay.
So I still remember what was happening. I think that monarchy by itself had, if I may use the term, disgraced itself.
Mm-hmm.
By then, 1974, it would have been even worse if the king was there, because he would have lost his dignity as well as the throne and the monarchy.
As well.
So I think it was better what happened. Later on, of course, there were many games, political games against him, who owned the properties. Were the property of the crown or the property of the monarch? The problems that we have today in England as well. Is the Buckingham Palace the property of the crown, of the office, or of the monarch of Queen Elizabeth and King Charles?
Mm. So, Rasinus, I mean, as a Greek, what do Greeks think when they look at this kind of quite bizarre relationship that Greece had experimenting with, you know, monarchs and dictatorships and republics during this period?
As a Greek, I thought it was very negative for the country itself. Despite the fact that he offered some stability in certain periods of time, it was overall very negative because... In England, as you remember, since the period of Queen Victoria became the regulator of the system. She didn't intervene in the way that the political affairs of the country and the political governance of the parliament was actually acting within the society itself. You had Disraeli, you had Gladstone, you had the Conservatives, you had the Progressives, and still there was an alternation in power without serious social unrest. In Greece, the king wanted to intervene constantly. We have the famous joke in Greece that at a certain stage when we had in 1875-76, when we had a sort of a kind of hung parliament, the king, it's a joke, I don't know, I'm not sure that actually happened, imposed his gardener as the prime minister of the country. And so this is what they say, I'll have my gardener as the prime minister for a period of time. King George, I mean there. On the other hand, King George would never showed any keen interest in Greece. He used to call it my toy kingdom. He used to play with them and spend most of his time in Nice, in France. You know, the whole thing. So he was going to Greece, changed government, gone back to Nice as well. So I didn't think we had, if I may say, it's very heavy what I'm going to say, a patriotic monarchy in the country. That is to say, a monarchy that came out of the people of Greece and actually cared for what happened in the people within the social fabric of the society. And that was a serious problem, I think. They gained the confidence, the family itself, gained the confidence of certain strata of a society, but not of the overall population. Despite the fact that we had some very interesting characters amongst them. For example, the mother of Prince Philip.
Now, this is what I was going to ask, because lots of people know there is a connection between Philip and Greece.
Princess Alice, right. Princess Alice was probably one of the most important philanthropists in the country. The woman who became a sort of a kind of who saved Jews during the German occupation. She stayed in Greece. She didn't go out. She was hiding Jews in her apartment in Athens. She established a place for nursing home for the orphan, for people, an orphanage for the elderly people, an orphanage for people of the war and Second World War, and then of the Civil War in the country. She was very active as an individual. She, you know, the famous story that she sold all her jewelry in order to make this orphanage for the orphans of the war. So she enjoyed very wide popularity in the country. Her son was quite a bit of a fruitcake, if I may call it, in Greece. Because
same this about Philip.
Yeah, because he had very ambivalent feelings. Because after the fall of the monarchy in 1924, you know how he escaped Greece. Because he was the son of the brother of the king. The Greeks were executing everyone who was sort of a kind of Greek opposition, arresting and executing most of the people who stood by the monarch. He was put in a basket with fruit in order to cover him, and he was actually shipped out of Corfu to Italy because they were afraid that they were going to kill him, and he was only 4 to 5 years old. So, I mean, that was, as you understand, a very traumatic experience for him as well. And the Greeks, for many, many years, thought of him as a sort of a kind of a traitor.
How do the Greeks feel about the British today, do you think?
For the British, they love them. Always. The Greeks are very pro-British, you know, always, despite the fact that they hate, you know, politics and they accuse them. Or they think that they aim for politics. They always thought of England as the place where they like to go. When they would like to go? London. On holidays, on meeting people, you know. The Greeks were always pro-British because the British people, going back, as we said, to the Romantics, gave a sense of pride, especially with Byron. The Greeks don't forget Byron to this day.
That's right, that sense that, that England and Britain was on the Greek side when they were trying to fight off the Ottomans.
And he wrote all these incredible sort of verses for the defence of Greece and the Greek Revolution. And finally, he died in Greece.
Yeah.
So the sacrifice of Byron said that always atones for every anti-Greek thing that, you know, that the British foreign policy has done against the Greeks, especially the civil war in the country.
Yeah.
But they love the British to this day, I think. Despite, as I said, the criticism, always Britain for them was probably the next, the place next to paradise. You know,
Rasmus, we will have to leave it there. Yeah. But it's a fascinating story just looking at the relationship between, you know, Greece and the monarchy and these different forms of government. So thank you for telling us this story on Nightlife tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Rasidis Karolas is the Sir Nicholas Laurentis Professor of Modern Greek at the University of Sydney.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.